is, it's really not the biggest deal in the world. We have 11,000 people on the plan. We get to dictate terms, right?
Thank you, Annie.
Someone from HR will call you tomorrow. You guys can work out the details. Gotta go again. Now I'm really late. And she hung up again.
May called her parents, telling her mom first, then her dad, and there was some whooping, and there were tears, more praise for Annie as the savior of the family, and some very embarrassing talk about how May had become a real adult, how her parents were ashamed and humbled to be leaning on her, leaning so heavily on their young daughter this way. It's just this messed-up system we're all stuck in, they said. But thank you, they said. We're so proud of you. And when she was alone on the phone with her mother said,
May, you've saved not just your father's life, but my life, too. I swear to God you have, my sweet Maybelline.
At 7, May found she couldn't stand it any longer. She couldn't sit still. She had to get up and celebrate in some way. She checked the campus that night. She'd missed the Sahara kickoff and already regretted it. There was a poetry slam, in costume, and she ranked that one first and even RSVP'd to it. But then she saw the cooking class in which they were going to roast and eat an entire goat. She ranked that second. At 9, there was an appearance by some activist wanting the Circle's help in her campaign against vaginal mutilation in Malawi. If she tried, May could get to at least a few of these events. But just when she was arranging some sort of itinerary, she saw something that obliterated all else. The Funky Arsehole Circus would be on campus, on the lawn next to the Iron Age, at 7. She'd heard of them, and their reviews and ratings were stellar, and the thought of a circus that night most matched her euphoria. She tried Annie, but she couldn't make it. She would be in her meeting till 11, at least. But Circle Search indicated a bunch of people she knew, including Renata and Alistair and Jared, would be there. The latter two already were. So she finished up and flew. The light was fading, threaded in gold, when she turned the corner of the Three Kingdoms and saw a man standing, 2 stories tall, blowing fire. Beyond him, a woman in a glittering headdress was throwing and catching a neon baton. May had found the circus. There were about 200 people forming a loose fence around the performers, who worked in open air, with minimal props and what seemed to be a decidedly limited budget. The circlers ringing the performance emitted an array of lights, some from their wrist monitors, some from their phones, out in a glow, capturing the proceedings. While May looked for Jared and Renata and cautiously kept an eye out for Alistair, she watched the circus swirl in front of her. There seemed to be no definite beginning to the show. It was already underway when she'd arrived, and no discernible structure to any of it. There were 10 or so members of the circus, all of them visible at all times, all of them wearing threadbare costumes that reveled in their antique humility. A smallish man did wild acrobatics while wearing a terrifying elephant mask. A mostly naked woman, her face obscured under a flamingo head, danced in circles, her movements alternating between ballet and a stumbling drunk. Just beyond her, May saw Alistair, who waved to her, and then began texting. Moments later, she checked her phone and saw that Alistair was putting on another, now bigger and better, event for all Portugal enthusiasts next week.
"It will be thunderous," he texted. "Films, music, poetry, storytelling, and joy."
She texted that she'd be there and could hardly wait. Across the lawn, past the flamingo, May saw him reading her message, watched as he raised his eyes to her, waving. She went back to watching the circus. The performers seemed to not be just affecting the air of poverty, but to be living it. Everything about them seemed old and smelled of age and decay. Around them, the circlers captured the performance on their screens, wanting to remember the very strangeness of this band of homeless-seeming revelers, to document how incongruous it was here at the Circle, amid the carefully considered paths and gardens, amid the people who worked there, who showered regularly, tried to stay at least reasonably fashionable, and who washed their clothes. May, making her way through the crowd, found Josiah and Denise, who were delighted to see her, but both seemed scandalized by the circus, the tone and tenor of which, they thought, had gone too far. Josiah had already reviewed it unfavorably. May left them, happy they'd seen her, had registered her attendance, and went looking for a beverage. She saw a row of booths in the distance, and was making her way to them when one of the performers, a shirtless man with a handlebar mustache, raced over to her, carrying 3 swords. He seemed unsteady, and in the moments before he reached her, May grasped that, though he wanted to seem under control, that this was part of his act, he was actually going to run into her with his arms full of blades.
She froze, and he was inches away from her when she felt her shoulders being grabbed and thrown. She fell to her knees, her back to the man with the swords.
"You okay?" a different man asked. She looked up to see he was standing where she'd been.
"I think so," she said. And then he turned back to the wiry sword man.
"What the fuck, clown?"
Was it Cowden? The sword juggler was looking to May to assure himself that she was okay, and when he saw that she was, he turned his attention to the man in front of him. It was Cowden. Now May was sure. He had Cowden's calligraphic shape. He was wearing a plain white V-neck undershirt and gray pants, as skinny as the jeans she'd first seen on him. He had not struck May as someone quick to fight, and yet he was standing, chest out and hands awake, as the circus performer assessed him, eyes steady, as if choosing between staying in character in this circus, following through with the show and getting paid, and paid well, by this enormous and prosperous and influential company, or tangling with this guy in front of 200 people. Finally, he chose to smile, theatrically twirl his mustache by both ends, and turn.
"Sorry that happened," Cowden said, helping her up. "You sure you're okay?"
May said she was. The mustache man hadn't touched her, had only scared her, and even then, only for a moment. She stared at his face, which in the suddenly blue light was like some Brancusi sculpture, smooth, perfectly oval. His eyebrows were Roman arches, his nose like some small sea creature's delicate snout.
"Those assholes shouldn't be here in the first place," he said.
"A bunch of court jesters here to entertain royalty. I don't see the point," he said, now looking around him, standing on his tiptoes.
"Can we leave here?"
They found the food and drinks table en route and took tapas and sausages and cups of red wine to a row of lemon trees behind the Viking Age.
"You don't remember my name," May said.
"No, but I know you, and I wanted to see you. That's why I was near when the mustache came at you."
"May."
"Right. I'm Cowden."
"I know. I remember names.
And I try to. I'm always trying. So are Josiah and Denise your friends?" he asked.
"I don't know. Sure. I mean, they did my orientation, and, you know, I've talked to them since."
"Why?"
"No reason."
"What do you do here, anyway? And Dan? You hang out with Dan?"
"Dan's my boss."
"You won't tell me what you do, will you?"
"You want a lemon?"
he asked, and stood. He kept his eyes on May as he reached his hand into the tree and retrieved a large one. There was a masculine grace to the gesture, how he stretched, fluidly upward, slower than might be expected, that made her think of a diver. Without looking at the lemon, he handed it to her.
"It's green," she said.
He squinted at it.
"Oh, I thought that would work. I went for the biggest one I could find. It should have been yellow. Here, stand up."
He gave her his hand, helped her up, and positioned her just away from the boughs of the tree. Then he threw his arms around the trunk and shook it until lemons rained down. 5 or 6 hit May.
"Jesus, sorry," he said. "I'm an idiot."
"No, it was good," she said. "They were heavy, and 2 hit me in the head. I loved it." He touched her then, shaping his hand around her head.
"Anything especially bad?"
She said she was fine.
"You always hurt the ones you love,"
he said, his face a dark shape above her. As if realizing what he'd said, he cleared his throat. "Anyway, that's what my parents said. And they loved me very much." In the morning, May called Annie, who was on her way to the airport, heading to Mexico to untangle some regulatory snafu.
"I met someone intriguing," May said.
"Good. I wasn't crazy about the other one. Gallipoli?"
"Garaventa."
"Francis. He's a nervous little mouse. And this new one, what do we know about him?" May could sense Annie speeding the conversation along. May tried to describe him, but realized she knew almost nothing.
"He's thin, brown eyes, tallish."
That's it? Brown eyes and tallish?
Oh, wait, May said, laughing at herself. He had gray hair. He has gray hair.
Wait, what?
He was young, but with gray hair.
Okay, May, it's okay if you're a grandpa chaser. No, no, I'm sure he was young. You say he's under 30, but with gray hair? I swear. I don't know anyone here like that.
You know all 10,000 people?
Maybe he's got some temporary contract. You didn't get his last name?
I tried, but he was very coy.
Huh, that's not so circly, is it?
And he had gray hair?
Almost white.
Like a swimmer would, when they use that shampoo?
No, this wasn't silver. It was just gray, like an old man would have.
And you're sure he wasn't some old man? Like some old man you found on the street?
No.
Were you roaming the streets, May? Are you into that particular smell of an older man, a much older man? It's musty, like a wet cardboard box. You like that?
Please.
Annie was entertaining herself, and so continued. I guess there's comfort there, knowing he can cash in his 401k, and he must be so grateful for any affection at all. Oh, shit, I'm at the airport. I'll call you back.
Annie didn't call back, but texted from the plane and later from Mexico City, sending May pictures of various old men she saw on the street.
Is this him? This one? That one? Ese? Ese?
May was left to wonder about all of this. How did she not know Cowden's last name? She did a preliminary search in the company directory and found no Cowdens. She tried K-A-L-D-A-N, K-A-L-D-I-N, K-H-A-L-D-E-N. Nothing. Maybe she'd misspelled it or misheard it. She could have done a more surgical search if she'd known what department he was in, what part of campus he might occupy, but she knew nothing. Still, she could think of little else. His white V-neck, his sad eyes that tried not to seem sad, his skinny gray pants that might have been stylish or horrible. She couldn't decide in the dark. The way he held her at the end of the night, when they'd walked to where the helicopters landed, hoping to see one, and then, seeing none, they walked back to the lemon grove, and there he said he would have to go, and could she walk to the shuttle from there? He pointed to the row of them, not 200 yards off, and she smiled and said she could handle it. Then he'd brought her to him, so suddenly, too suddenly for her to know if he planned a kiss or a grope or what. What he did was a flattening of her shape against his, with his right arm crossing her back, his hand atop her shoulder, and his left hand far lower, bolder, resting on her sacrum, his fingers fanning down. Then he pulled away and smiled.
You sure you're okay?
I am.
You're not scared?
She laughed.
No, I'm not scared.
Okay. Good night.
And he turned and walked in a new direction, not toward the shuttles or the helicopters or the circus, but through a narrow, shadowed path, alone. All week, she thought of his retreating form and his strong hands reaching, and she looked at the big green lemon he'd picked, which she'd retrieved and thought, wrongly, would have ripened on her desk if given the time. It stayed green. But she couldn't get hold of him. She put out a few all-company zings, looking for a Cowden, careful not to look desperate, but she got no response. She knew Annie could figure it out, but Annie was now in Peru. The company was in some moderately hot water over their plans in the Amazon, something involving drones to count and photograph every remaining tree. Between meetings with members of various environmental and regulatory officials, Annie finally called back.
Let me do a facial rec on him. Send me a photo.
But May had no photos of him.
You're kidding. Nothing?
It was dark. It was a circus.
You said that. So he gave you a green lemon and no photos? Are you sure he wasn't just visiting?
But I met him before, remember? Near the bathroom? And then he came back to my desk and watched me work?
Wow, May, this guy sounds like a winner. Green lemons and heavy breathing over your shoulder while you answer customer queries. If I were being the slightest bit paranoid, I think he was an infiltrator of some kind, or a low-grade molester.
Annie had to hang up, but then, an hour later, texted,
You have to keep me posted on this guy, getting increasingly unsettled. We've had some weird stalker people over the years. Last year we had a guy, some kind of blogger, who attended a party and stayed on campus for 2 weeks, skulking around and sleeping in storage rooms. He turned out to be relatively harmless, but you can see how some unidentified freaky man would be cause for concern. But May wasn't concerned. She trusted Calden, and couldn't believe he had any nefarious intentions. His face had an openness, an unmistakable lack of guile. May couldn't quite explain it to Annie, but she had no doubts about him. She knew, though, that he was not reliable as a communicator, but she knew also, she was sure of it, that he would contact her again. And though being unable to reach anyone else in her life would have been grating, exasperating, having him out there, at least for a few days, unreachable but presumably somewhere on campus, provided a jolt of welcome frisson to her hours. The week's workload was heavy, but while thinking of Calden, every query was some glorious aria. The customers sang to her and she sang back. She loved them all. She loved Risa Thomason in Twin Falls, Idaho. She loved Mac Moore in Gary, Indiana. She loved the newbies around her. She loved Jared's occasionally worried visage appearing in his doorway, asking her to see how they could keep their aggregate over 98. And she loved that she had been able to ignore Francis and his constant contacting of her, his mini videos, his audio greeting cards, his playlists, all of them songs of apology and woe. He was a memory now, obliterated by Calden and his elegant silhouette, his strong, searching hands. She loved how she could, alone in the bathroom, simulate the effect of those hands, could, with her own hand, approximate the pressure he applied to her. But where was he? What had been intriguing on Monday and Tuesday was approaching annoying by Wednesday and exasperating by Thursday. His invisibility began to feel intentional and even aggressive. He'd promised to be in touch, hadn't he? Maybe he hadn't, she thought. What had he said? She searched her memory and realized, with a kind of panic, that all he'd said at the end of the night was, "Good night." But Annie would be coming back on Friday, and together, with even an hour together, they could find him, know his name, lock him in. And finally, on Friday morning, Annie returned, and they made plans to meet just before the Dream Friday. There was supposed to be a presentation about the future of Circle Money, a way to send all online purchases through the Circle and eventually obviate the need for paper currency at all. But then the presentation was canceled. All staffers were asked to watch a press conference being held in Washington. May hurried down to the lobby of the Renaissance, where a few hundred circlers were watching the wall screen. A woman in a blueberry-colored suit stood behind a podium festooned with microphones, surrounded by aides and a pair of American flags. Below her, the ticker. Senator Williamson seeking to break up the circle. It was too loud at first to hear anything, but a series of hissing shushes and volume increases made her voice audible. The senator was in the middle of reading a written statement. "We are here today to insist that the Senate's Antitrust Task Force begin an investigation into whether or not the Circle acts as a monopoly. We believe that the Justice Department will see the Circle for what it is, a monopoly in its purest sense, and move to break it up, just as they did with Standard Oil, AT&T, and every other demonstrated monopoly in our history. The dominance of the Circle stifles competition and is dangerous to our way of free market capitalism." After she was finished, the screen went back to its usual purpose, to celebrate the thoughts of the Circle staff, and amid the throngs that day were many thoughts. The consensus was that this senator was known for her occasionally outside the mainstream positions. She had been against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and thus she would not get much traction with this antitrust crusade. The Circle was a company popular on both sides of the aisle, known for its pragmatic positions on virtually every political issue, for its generous donations, and thus this left-of-center senator wouldn't get much support from her liberal colleagues, much less among the Republican ranks. May didn't know enough about antitrust laws to have an off-the-cuff opinion. Was there really no competition out there? The Circle had 90% of the search market, 88% of the free mail market, 92% of text servicing. That was, in her perspective, a simple testament to their making and delivering the best product. It seemed insane to punish the company for its efficiency, for its attention to detail, for succeeding. "There you are," May said, seeing Annie coming toward her. "How was Mexico and Peru?" "That idiot," Annie scoffed, narrowing her eyes at the screen where the senator had recently appeared.
So you're not concerned about this?
You mean like she's going to actually get somewhere with this? No. But personally, she's in a world of shit.
What do you mean? How do you know this?
Annie looked at May, then turned to face the back of the room. Tom Stenton stood, chatting with a few circlers, his arms crossed, a posture that in someone else might convey concern or even anger, but more than anything, he seemed amused.
Let's go,
Annie said, and they walked across campus, hoping to get lunch from a taco truck hired to feed circlers that day.
How's your gentleman caller? Don't tell me he died during sex.
I still haven't seen him since last week.
No contact at all? Annie asked. What a shit.
I think he's just from some other era.
Some other era? And gray hair? May, you know that moment in The Shining when Nicholson is having some kind of sexy encounter with the woman in the bathroom, and then the lady turns out to be some elderly undead corpse?
May had no idea what Annie was talking about.
Actually,
Annie said, and her eyes lost focus.
What?
You know, with this Williamson investigation thing, it worries me to have some shadowy guy skulking around campus. Can you tell me the next time you see him?
May looked at Annie and saw for the first time she could remember something like real worry.
At 4:30, Dan sent a message.
Great day so far. Meet at 5?
May arrived at Dan's door. He stood, guided her to a chair, and closed the door. He sat behind his desk and tapped the glass of his tablet.
97, 98, 98, 98. Wonderful aggregates this week.
Thank you, May said.
Really spectacular, especially considering the increased workload with the noobs. Has that been difficult?
Maybe the first couple of days, but now they're all trained and don't need me as much. They're all excellent, so if anything, it's slightly easier having more people on the job.
Good. Good to hear.
Now Dan looked up and probed into her eyes.
May, have you had a good experience so far here at the Circle?
Absolutely,
she said. His face brightened.
Good, good. That's very good news. I asked you to come in just to, well, to square that with your social behavior here and the message it's sending. And I think I might have failed to communicate everything about this job properly. So I blame myself if I haven't done that well enough.
No, no. I know you did a good job. I'm sure you did.
Well, thank you, May. I appreciate that. But what we need to talk about is the, well, let me put it another way. You know, this isn't what you might call a clock-in, clock-out type of company. Does that make sense?
Oh, I know. I wouldn't. Did I imply that I thought?
No, no, you didn't imply anything.
We just haven't seen you around so much after 5 o'clock,
so we wondered if you were, you know, anxious to leave.
No, no. Do you need me to stay later?
Dan winced.
No, it's not that. You handle your workload just fine, but we missed you at the Old West party last Thursday night, which is a pretty crucial team-building event, centered around a product we're all very proud of. You missed at least 2 newbie events, and at the circus it looked like you couldn't wait to leave. I think you were out of there in 20 minutes, and those things would be understandable if your participation rank wasn't so low. Do you know what it is?
May guessed it was in the 8,000 range.
I think so.
You think so?
Dan said, checked his screen.
It's 9,101. Does that sound right?
It had dropped in the last hour since she'd last checked. Dan clucked and nodded, as if trying to figure out how a certain spot had appeared on his shirt.
So it's been sort of adding up and, well, we started worrying that we were somehow driving you away.
No, no, it's nothing like that.
Okay, let's focus on Thursday at 5:15. We had a gathering in the Old West where your friend Annie works. It was a semi-mandatory welcome party for a group of potential partners. You were off campus, which really confuses me. It's as if you were fleeing.
May's mind raced. Why hadn't she gone? Where was she? She didn't know about this event. It was across campus in the Old West. How had she missed a semi-mandatory event? The notice must have been buried deep in her third screen.
God, I'm sorry, she said, remembering now.
At 5, I left campus to get some aloe at this health shop in San Vincenzo. My dad asked for this particular kind of...
May?
Dan interrupted, his tone condescending.
The company's store has aloe. Our store's better stocked than some corner store, and with superior products. Ours is carefully curated.
I'm sorry, I didn't know the company store had something like aloe.
You went to our store and couldn't find it?
No, no, I didn't go to the store. I went straight to the other store, but I'm so glad to know that.
Let me stop you there, because you said something interesting. You said you didn't go to our store first.
No, sorry, I just assumed something like that wouldn't be there, so...
Now listen, May, I should admit that I know you didn't go to the store. That's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. You haven't been in the store, not once. You, a former college athlete, haven't been to the gym, and you've barely explored the campus. I think you've used about 1% of our facilities.
I'm sorry. It's just been a whirlwind so far, I guess.
And Friday night, there was a major event then, too.
I'm sorry. I wanted to go to the party, but I had to run home. My dad had a seizure, and it ended up being minor, but I didn't know that until I got home.
Dan looked at his glass desk and, with a tissue, tried to remove a smudge. Satisfied, he looked up.
That's very understandable. To spend time with your parents, believe me, I think that is very, very cool. I just want to emphasize the community aspect of this job. We see this workplace as a community, and every person who works here is part of that community. And to make it all work, it requires a certain level of participation. It's like if we were a kindergarten class and one girl has a party and only half the class shows up, how does the birthday girl feel?
Not good. I know that, but I was at the circus event, and that was great. So great.
It was great, wasn't it? And it was great to see you there, but we have no record of you being there. No photos, no zings, no reviews, notices, bumps. Why not?
I don't know. I guess I was caught up in the...
Dan sighed loudly.
You do know that we like to hear from people, right? That Circler's opinions are valued.
Of course.
And that the Circle is predicated, to a large extent, on the input and participation of people like yourself.
I know.
Listen, it totally makes sense you'd want to spend time with your parents. They're your parents. It's totally honorable of you. Like I said, very, very cool. I'm just saying we like you a lot, too, and want to know you better. To that end, I wonder if you'd be willing to stay a few extra minutes to talk to Josiah and Denise. I think you remember them from your orientation. They'd love to just extend the conversation we're having and go a bit deeper. Does that sound good?
Sure.
You don't have to rush home or...
No, I'm all yours.
Good. Good. I like to hear that. Here they are now.
May turned to see Denise and Josiah, both waving, on the other side of Dan's glass door.
May, how are you?
Denise said, as they walked to the conference room.
I can't believe it's been 3 weeks since we gave you your first tour. We'll be in here.
Josiah opened the door to a conference room May had passed many times. The room was oval, the walls glass.
"Let's have you sit here," Denise said, indicating a high-backed leather chair.
She and Josiah sat across from her, arranging their tablets and adjusting their seats, as if settling in for a task that might take hours and would almost surely be unpleasant. May tried to smile.
"As you know," Denise said, putting a strand of her dark hair behind her ear. "We're from HR, and this is just a regular check-in we do with new community members here. We do them somewhere in the company every day, and we're especially glad to see you again. You're such an enigma."
"I am?"
"You are. It's been years since I can remember someone joining who was so, you know, shrouded in mystery."
May wasn't sure how to answer this. She didn't feel shrouded in mystery.
"So I thought maybe we would start by talking a little about you, and after we get to know more about you, we can talk about ways that you might feel comfortable joining in a bit more in terms of the community. Does that sound good?"
May nodded.
"Of course."
She looked to Josiah, who hadn't said a word yet, but who was working furiously on his tablet, typing and swiping.
"Good. I thought we would start by saying that we really like you," Denise said.
Josiah finally spoke, his blue eyes bright.
"We do," he said. "We really do. You are a super cool member of the team. Everyone thinks so."
"Thank you," May said, feeling sure that she was being fired.
She'd gone too far in asking for her parents to be added to the insurance plan. How could she have done that so soon after being hired?
"And that your work here has been exemplary," Denise continued.
Your ratings have been averaging 97, and that's excellent, especially for your first month. Do you feel satisfied with your performance?
May guessed at the right answer.
I do.
Denise nodded.
Good, but as you know, it's not all about work here, or rather, it's not all about ratings and approvals and such. You're not just some cog in a machine.
Josiah was shaking his head vigorously. No.
We consider you a full, knowable human being of unlimited potential and a crucial member of the community.
Thank you, May said, now less sure she was being let go.
Denise's smile was pained.
But as you know, you've had a blip or two when it comes to meshing with the community here. We have, of course, read the report from the incident with Alistair and his Portugal brunch. We found your explanation totally understandable, and we're encouraged that you seem to have recognized the issues at play there, but then there's your absence at most of the weekend and evening events, all of which are, of course, totally optional. Is there anything else you want to add to our understanding of all this? Maybe with the Alistair situation?
Just that I felt really bad that I might have inadvertently caused Alistair any distress.
Denise and Josiah smiled.
Good, good, Denise said.
So the fact that you understand makes me confused, in terms of squaring that with a few of your actions since that discussion. Let's start with this past weekend. We know you left campus at 5:42 p.m. on Friday, and you got back here at 8:46 a.m. on Monday.
Was there work on the weekend?
May searched her memory.
Did I miss something?
No. There wasn't, you know, mandatory work here on the weekend. That's not to say that there weren't thousands of people here Saturday and Sunday enjoying the campus, participating in 100 different activities.
I know, but I was home. My dad was sick, and I went back to help out.
I'm sorry to hear that, Josiah said. Was this related to his MS?
It was.
Josiah made a sympathetic face, and Denise leaned forward.
But see, here's where it gets especially confusing. We don't know anything about this episode. Did you reach out to any circlers during this crisis? You know that there are 4 groups on campus for staffers dealing with MS. 2 of them are for children of MS sufferers. Have you sought out one of these groups?
No, not yet. I've meant to.
Okay, Denise said. Let's table that thought for a second, because that's instructive. The fact that you were aware of the groups, but didn't seek them out. Surely you acknowledge the benefit of sharing information about this disease.
I do.
And that sharing with other young people whose parents suffer from the disease, do you see the benefit in this?
Absolutely.
For example, when you heard your dad had a seizure, you drove, what, 100 miles or so, and never once during that drive did you try to glean any information from the inner circlers or from the larger outer circle. Do you see that as an opportunity wasted?
Now I do. Absolutely. I was just upset and worried, and I was driving like a maniac. I wasn't very present.
Denise raised a finger.
Ah, present. That is a wonderful word. I'm glad you used it. Do you consider yourself usually present?
I try to be.
Josiah smiled and tapped a flurry into his tablet.
But the opposite of present would be what?
Denise asked.
Absent?
Yes, absent.
Let's put a pin in that thought, too. Let's go back to your dad and this weekend. Did he recover okay?
He did. It was a false alarm, really.
Good. I'm so glad to hear about that. But it's curious that you didn't share this with anyone else. Did you post anything anywhere about this episode? A zing? A comment anywhere?
No, I didn't, May said.
Okay,
Denise said, taking a breath.
Do you think someone else might have benefited from your experience? That is, maybe the next person who might drive 2 or 3 hours home might benefit from knowing what you found out about the episode, that it was just a minor pseudo-seizure?
Absolutely. I could see that being helpful.
Good. So what do you think the action plan should be?
I think I'll join the MS Club, May said. And I should post something about what happened. I know it'll be beneficial.
Denise smiled. Fantastic. Now let's talk about the rest of the weekend. On Friday, you find out that your dad's okay, but the rest of the weekend, you basically go blank. It's like you disappeared.
Her eyes grew wide.
This is when someone like you, with a low participation rank, might be able to improve that, if she wanted to, but yours actually dropped. 2,000 points. Not to get all number geeky, but you were on 8,625 on Friday, and by late Sunday, you were at 10,288. I didn't know it was that bad, May said, hating herself, this self who couldn't seem to get out of her own way. I guess I was just recovering from the stress of my dad's episode. Can you talk about what you did on Saturday?
It's embarrassing, May said. Nothing.
Nothing meaning what?
Well, most of the day I stayed at my parents' house and just watched TV.
Josiah brightened.
Anything good?
Just some women's basketball.
There's nothing wrong with women's basketball, Josiah gushed. I love women's basketball. Have you followed my WNBA zings?
No. Do you have a zing feed about the WNBA?
Josiah nodded, looking hurt, even bewildered. Denise stepped in.
Again, it's just curious that you didn't choose to share it with anyone. Did you join any of the discussions about the sport? Josiah, how many participants are there in our global WNBA discussion group?
Josiah, still visibly shaken, knowing that May hadn't been reading his WNBA feed, managed to find the number on his tablet and muttered,
143,891.
And how many zingers out there focus on the WNBA? Josiah quickly found the number.
12,992.
And you're not part of either, May. Why do you think that is?
I guess I just didn't think my interest in the WNBA rose to the level where it warranted joining a discussion group or, you know, following anything. I'm not that passionate about it.
Denise squinted at May. That's an interesting choice of words. Passion. You've heard of PPT? Passion, participation, and transparency?
May had seen the letters PPT around campus and had not, until that moment, connected the letters to these three words. She felt like a fool. Denise put her palms on the desk, as if she might get up.
May, you know this is a technology company, correct?
Of course.
And that we consider ourselves on the forefront of social media.
Yes.
And you know the term transparency, correct?
I do, absolutely.
Josiah looked at Denise, hoping to calm her. She put her hands in her lap. Josiah took over. He smiled and swiped his tablet, turning a new page.
Okay, let's go to Sunday. Tell us about Sunday.
I just drove back.
That's it?
I kayaked.
Josiah and Denise registered dual looks of surprise.
You kayaked?
Josiah said.
Where?
Just in the bay.
With who?
No one, just alone.
Denise and Josiah looked hurt.
I kayak,
Josiah said, and then typed something in his tablet, pressing very hard.
How often do you kayak?
Denise asked May.
Maybe once every few weeks?
Josiah was looking intently at his tablet.
May, I'm looking at your profile. I'm finding nothing about you and kayaking. No smiles, no ratings, no posts, nothing. And now you're telling me you kayak once every few weeks?
Well, maybe it's less than that.
May laughed, but Denise and Josiah did not. Josiah continued to stare at his screen while Denise's eyes probed into May.
When you go kayaking, what do you see?
I don't know. All kinds of things.
Seals?
Sure.
Sea lions?
Usually.
Water birds? Pelicans?
Sure.
Denise tapped at her tablet.
Okay, I'm doing a search now of your name for visual documentation of any of these trips you've taken. I'm not finding anything.
Oh, I've never brought a camera.
But how do you identify all these birds?
I have this little guide. It's just a thing my ex-boyfriend gave me. It's a little foldable guide to local wildlife.
So it's just a pamphlet or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's waterproof, and Josiah exhaled loudly. I'm sorry, May said.
Josiah rolled his eyes.
No, I mean, this is a tangent, but my problem with paper is that all communication dies with it. It holds no possibility of continuity. You look at your paper brochure and that's where it ends. It ends with you. Like, you're the only one who matters. But think if you've been documenting. If you've been using a tool that would help confirm the identity of whatever birds you saw, then anyone can benefit. Naturalists, students, historians, the Coast Guard. Everyone can know then what birds were on the bay on that day.
It's just maddening thinking of how much knowledge is lost every day through this kind of short-sightedness. And I don't want to call it selfish, but no, it was. I know it was, May said.
Josiah softened. But documentation aside, I'm just fascinated why you wouldn't mention anything about kayaking anywhere. I mean, it's a part of you, an integral part.
May let out an involuntary scoff. I don't think it's all that integral, or interesting, really.
Josiah looked up, his eyes fiery.
But it is.
Lots of people kayak, May said.
That's exactly it,
Josiah said, quickly turning red.
Wouldn't you like to meet other people who kayak?
Josiah tapped at his screen.
There are 2,331 people near you who also like to kayak, including me.
May smiled. That's a lot.
More or less than you expected? Denise asked.
More, I guess, May said.
Josiah and Denise smiled.
So, should we sign you up to hear more about the people near you who like to kayak? There are so many tools.
Josiah seemed to be opening a page where he could sign her up.
Oh, I don't know, May said.
Their faces plummeted. Josiah seemed angry again.
Why not? Do you think your passions are unimportant?
That's not quite it. I just...
Josiah leaned forward.
How do you think other circlers feel, knowing that you're so close to them physically, that you're ostensibly part of a community here, but you don't want them to know your hobbies and interests? How do you think they feel?
I don't know. I don't think they'd feel anything.
But they do,
Josiah said.
The point is that you're not engaged with the people around you.
It's just kayaking, May said, laughing again, trying to bring the discussion back to a place of levity.
Josiah was at work on his tablet.
Just kayaking? Do you realize that kayaking is a $3 billion industry, and you say it's just kayaking? May, don't you see that it's all connected? You play your part. You have to participate.
Denise was looking at May intensely. May, I have to ask a delicate question.
Okay, May said.
Do you think this might be an issue of self-esteem?
Excuse me?
Are you reluctant to express yourself because you fear your opinions aren't valid?
May had never thought about it quite this way, but it made a certain sense. Was she too shy about expressing herself? I don't know, actually, she said.
Denise narrowed her eyes. May, I'm no psychologist, but if I were, I might have a question about your sense of self-worth. We've studied some models for this kind of behavior. Not to say this kind of attitude is antisocial, but it's certainly subsocial and certainly far from transparent. And we see that this behavior sometimes stems from a low sense of self-worth, a point of view that says, oh, what I have to say isn't so important. Do you feel that describes your point of view?
May was too off balance to see herself clearly. Maybe, she said, buying time, knowing she shouldn't be too pliant. But sometimes I'm sure that what I say is important, and when I have something significant to add, I definitely feel empowered to do it.
But notice, you said sometimes, I'm sure,
Josiah said, wagging a finger.
The sometimes is interesting to me, or concerning, I should say, because I think you're not finding that sometime frequently enough.
He sat back, as if resting after the hard work of solving her was complete.
May, Denise said.
We'd love if you could participate in a special program. Does that sound appealing?
May knew nothing about it, but knew, because she was in trouble and had already consumed so much of their time, she should say yes. So she smiled and said,
Absolutely.
Good. As soon as we can, we'll hook you up. You'll meet Pete Ramirez, and he'll explain it. I think it might make you feel sure not just sometimes, but always. Does that sound better?
After the interview at her desk, May scolded herself. What kind of person was she? More than anything, she was ashamed. She'd been doing the bare minimum. She disgusted herself and felt for Annie. Surely Annie had been hearing about her deadbeat friend, May.
who took this gift, this coveted job at the Circle, a company that had insured her parents, had saved them from familial catastrophe, and had been skating through. God damn it, May, give a shit, she thought. Be a person of some value to the world.
She wrote to Annie, apologizing, saying she would do better, that she was embarrassed, that she didn't want to abuse this privilege, this gift, and telling her that there was no need to write back, that she would simply do better, 1,000 times better, immediately, and from then on. Annie texted back, told her not to worry, that it was just a slap on the wrist, a correction, a common thing for newbies.
May looked at the time. It was 6 o'clock. She had plenty of hours to improve, there and then, so she embarked on a flurry of activity, sending 4 zings and 32 comments and 88 smiles. In an hour, her party rank rose to 7,288. Breaking 7,000 was more difficult, but by 8 o'clock, after joining and posting in 11 discussion groups, sending another 12 zings, one of them rated in the top 5,000 globally for that hour, and signing up for 67 more feeds, she'd done it. She was at 6,872 and turned to her Inner Circle social feed. She was a few hundred posts behind, and she made her way through, replying to 70 or so messages, RSVPing to 11 events on campus, signing 9 petitions, and providing comments and constructive criticism on 4 products currently in beta. By 10:16, her rank was 5,342, and again, the plateau, this time at 5,000, was hard to overcome. She wrote a series of zings about a new Circle service, allowing account holders to know whenever their name was mentioned in any messages sent from anyone else, and one of the zings, her 7th on the subject, caught fire and was re-zinged 2,904 times, and this brought her party rank up to 3,887. She felt a profound sense of accomplishment and possibility that was accompanied, in short order, by a near-complete sense of exhaustion. It was almost midnight, and she needed sleep. It was too late to go all the way home, so she checked the dorm availability, reserved one, got her access code, walked across campus, and into hometown. When she closed the door to her room, she felt like a fool for not taking advantage of the dorms sooner. The room was immaculate, awash in silver fixtures and blonde woods, the floors warm from radiant heat, the sheets and pillowcases so white and crisp they crackled when touched. The mattress, explained a card next to the bed, was organic, made not with springs or foam, but instead a new fiber that May found was both firmer and more pliant, superior to any bed she'd ever known. She pulled the blanket, cloud white and full of down, around her. But she couldn't sleep. Now, thinking about how much better she could do, she logged on again, this time on her tablet, and pledged to work till 2 in the morning. She was determined to break 3,000, and she did so, though it was 3:19 a.m. when it happened. Finally, not quite exhausted, but knowing she needed rest, she tucked herself in and turned off the lights. In the morning, May looked through the closets and dressers, knowing that the dorms were stocked with an array of clothes, all new, available to be borrowed or kept. She chose a cotton t-shirt and a pair of capri pants, both pristine. On the sink there were new bottles of moisturizer and mouthwash, both organic and local, and she sampled each. She showered, dressed, and was back at her desk by 8:20. And immediately, the fruits of her labors were evident. There was a river of congratulatory messages on her third screen, from Dan, Jared, Josiah, Denise, 5 or so messages from each of them, and at least 12 from Annie, who seemed so proud and excited she might burst. Word spread through the Inner Circle, and May was sent 7,716 smiles by noon. Everyone had known she could do it. Everyone saw great things for her at the Circle. Everyone was certain she would graduate from CE in no time, as soon as September, because rarely had anyone risen so quickly through the party rank and with such laser-like focus. May's new feeling of competence and confidence carried her through the week, and given how close she was to the top 2,000, she stayed at her desk late through the weekend and early the next week, determined to crack through, sleeping in the same dorm room every night. She knew the upper 2,000, nicknamed T2K, was a group of Circlers almost maniacal in their social activity and elite in their corresponding followers. The members of the T2K had been more or less locked in place, with few additions or movements within their ranks, for almost 18 months. But May knew she needed to try. By Thursday night, she'd gotten to 2,219, and knew she was among a group of similar strivers who were, like her, working feverishly to rise. She worked for an hour and saw herself climb only 2 spots to 2,217. This would be difficult, she knew, but the challenge was delicious,
And every time she'd risen to a new thousand, she received so many accolades and felt she was repaying Annie in particular that it drove her on. By 10 o'clock, just when she was tiring, and when she'd gotten as high as 2,188, she had the revelation that she was young, and she was strong, and if she worked through the night, one night without sleep, she could crack the T2K while everyone else was unconscious. She fortified herself with an energy drink and gummy worms, and when the caffeine and sugar kicked in, she felt invincible. The third screen's inner circle wasn't enough. She turned on her outer circle feed and was handling that without difficulty. She pushed forward, signing up for a few hundred more Zing feeds, starting with a comment on each. She was soon at 2012, and now she was really getting resistance. She posted 33 comments on a product test site and rose to 2009. She looked at her left wrist to see how her body was responding and thrilled at the sight of her pulse rate increasing. She was in command of all this and needed more. The total number of stats she was tracking was only 41. There was her aggregate customer service score, which was at 97. There was her last score, which was 99. There was the average of her pod, which was at 96. There was the number of queries handled that day thus far, 221. And the number of queries handled by that time yesterday, 219. And the number handled by her on average, 220. And by the pod's other members, 198. On her second screen, there were the number of messages sent by other staffers that day, 1,192, and the number of those messages that she'd read, 239, and the number to which she'd responded, 88. There was the number of recent invitations to Circle Company events, 41, and the number she'd responded to, 28. There was the number of overall visitors to the Circle sites that day, 3.2 billion, and the number of page views, 88.7 billion. There was the number of friends in May's outer circle, 762, and outstanding requests by those wanting to be her friend, 27. There were the number of zingers she was following, 10,343, and the number following her, 18,198. There was the number of unread zings, 887. There was the number of zingers suggested to her, 12,862. There was the number of songs in her digital library, 6,877, number of artists represented, 921, and based on her tastes, the number of artists recommended to her, 3,408. There was the number of images in her library, 33,002, and number of images recommended to her, 100,038. There was the temperature inside the building, 70, and the temperature outside, 71. There was the number of staffers on campus that day, 10,981, and number of visitors to campus that day, 248. May had news alerts set for 45 names and subjects, and each time any one of them was mentioned by any of the news feeds she favored, she received a notice. That day, there were 187. She could see how many people had viewed her profile that day, 210, and how much time on average they spent, 1.3 minutes. If she wanted, of course, she could go deeper and see precisely what each person had viewed. Her health stats added a few dozen more numbers, each of them giving her a sense of great calm and control. She knew her heart rate and knew it was right. She knew her step count, almost 8,200 that day, and knew that she could get to 10,000 with ease. She knew she was properly hydrated and that her caloric intake that day was within accepted norms for someone of her body mass index. It occurred to her in a moment of sudden clarity that what had always caused her anxiety or stress or worry was not any one force, nothing independent and external. It wasn't danger to herself or the constant calamity of other people and their problems. It was internal. It was subjective. It was not knowing. It wasn't that she had an argument with a friend or was called on the carpet by Josiah and Denise. It was not knowing what it meant, not knowing their plans, not knowing the consequences, the future. If she knew these, there would be calm. She knew, with some degree of certainty, where her parents were, home, as always. She could see, with her circle search, where Annie was, in her office, probably still working, too. But where was Cowden? It had been 2 weeks since she'd seen or heard from him. She texted Annie. You awake?
Always.
Still haven't heard from Cowden.
The old man. Maybe he died. He had a good long life.
You really think he was just some interloper?
I think you dodged a bullet. I'm glad he hasn't come back. I was worried about the espionage possibilities.
He wasn't a spy.
Then he was just old. Maybe some circler's grandfather came to visit and got lost. It's just as well. You were too young to be a widow.
May thought of his hands. His hands had ruined her. All she wanted at that moment was his hands upon her again, his hand on her sacrum, pulling her close. Could her desires be so simple?
And where in the hell had he gone? He had no right to disappear like this. She checked Circle Search again. She'd looked for him 100 times this way, with no success. But she had a right to know where he was, to at least know where he was, who he was. This was the unnecessary and antiquated burden of uncertainty. She could know instantly the temperature in Jakarta, but she couldn't find one man on a campus like this. Where is that man who touched you a certain way? If she could eliminate this kind of uncertainty, when and by whom would you be touched a certain way again? You would eliminate most of the stressors of the world, and maybe, too, the wave of despair that was gathering in May's chest. She'd been feeling this black rip, this loud tear, within her a few times a week. It didn't usually last long, but when she closed her eyes, she saw a tiny tear in what seemed to be black cloth, and through this tiny tear she heard the screams of millions of invisible souls. It was a very strange thing, she realized, and it wasn't anything she'd mentioned to anyone. She might have described it to Annie, but didn't want to worry her so soon into her time at the Circle. But what was this feeling? Who was screaming through the tear in the cloth? She'd found the best way to get past it was to redouble her focus, to stay busy, to give more. She had a brief, silly thought that she might find Calden on Love-Love. She checked and felt stupid when her doubts were confirmed. The tear was opening up inside her, a blackness overtaking her. She closed her eyes and heard underwater screams. May cursed the not knowing, and knew she needed someone who could be known, who could be located.
The knock on the door was low and tentative.
"It's open,"
May said. Francis pushed his face into the room and held the door.
"You sure?"
he said.
"I invited you,"
May said. He slipped in and closed the door, as if narrowly escaping from a pursuer in the hallway. He looked around the room.
"Like what you've done with the place?"
May laughed.
"Let's go to mine instead,"
he said. She thought of protesting, but wanted to see what his room looked like. All the dorm rooms varied in subtle ways, and now, because they'd become so popular and practical that many circlers were living in them more or less permanently, they could be customized by their occupants. When they arrived, she saw that his room was a mirror of her own, though with a few Francis touches, most notably a papier-mâché mask he'd made as a child. Yellow and with enormous bespectacled eyes, it looked out from over the bed. He saw her staring at it.
"What?"
he said.
"That's odd, don't you think? A mask over the bed?"
"I don't see it when I sleep," he said. "You want something to drink?"
He looked in the fridge, finding juices and a new kind of sake in a round glass container tinted pink.
"That looks good," she said. "I don't have that in my room. Mine's in a more standard bottle, maybe a different brand."
Francis mixed drinks for them both, overfilling each glass.
"I have a few shots every night,"
he said.
"It's the only way to slow my head down so I can crash. You have that problem?"
"It takes me an hour to get to sleep," May said.
"Well,"
Francis said,
"this reduces that come down from an hour to 15 minutes.
He handed her the glass. May looked into it, thinking it very sad at first, the sake every night, then knew she would try it herself tomorrow. He was looking at something between her stomach and her elbow.
"What?"
"I can never get over your waist," he said.
"Excuse me?"
May said, thinking it was not worth it. It couldn't be worth it to be with this man who said things like this.
"No, no," he said. "I mean, it's so extraordinary, the line of it, how it bends in like some kind of bow."
And then his hands were tracing the contour of her waist, drawing a long C in the air.
"I love that you have hips and shoulders, and with that waist."
He smiled, staring straight into May, as if he had no idea of the strange directness of what he'd said, or didn't care.
"I guess, thank you," she said.
"That's really a compliment," he said. "It's like these curves were created for someone to put their hands there."
He mimed the resting of his own palms upon her waist. She stood, took a sip of her drink, and wondered if she should flee. But it was a compliment. He'd given her an inappropriate, clumsy, but
very direct compliment that she knew she would never forget and that had already set her heart to a new and erratic pounding. "You want to watch something?" Francis asked. May shrugged, still struck dumb. Francis scrolled through the options. They had access to virtually every movie and television show extant, and spent 5 minutes noting different things they could see, then thinking of something else that was like it, but better.
"Have you heard this new stuff by Hans Willis?"
Francis asked. May had decided to stay, and had decided that she felt good about herself around Francis, that she had power here, and she liked that power.
"Now, who's he?"
"He's one of the musicians in residence. He recorded a whole concert last week."
"Is it out?"
"No, but if it gets good ratings from circlers, they might try to release it.
Let me see if I can find it."
He played it, a delicate piano piece, sounding like the beginning of Rain. May got up to turn off the lights, allowing the gray luminescence of the monitor to remain, casting Francis in a ghostly light. She noticed a thick, leathery book and picked it up.
"What's this? I don't have one of these in my room."
"Oh, that's mine. It's an album, just pictures."
"Like family pictures?"
May asked, and then remembered his complicated history.
"Sorry, I know that's probably not the best way to put it."
"It's okay," he said. "They're sort of family pictures. My siblings are in some of them, but they're mostly just me and the Foster families. You want to look?"
"You keep it here at the circle?"
He took it from May and sat on the bed.
"No, it's usually at home, but I brought it in. You want to look at it? It's mostly depressing."
Francis had already opened the album. May sat next to him and watched as he turned the pages. She saw glimpses of Francis in modest living rooms, amber-lit, and in kitchens, the occasional amusement park. Always the parents were blurry or cropped from the frames. He arrived at a photo of himself sitting on a skateboard, looking out through enormous glasses.
"Those must have been the mother's," he said. "Look at the frames."
He drew his finger over the round lenses.
"That's a woman's style, right?"
"I think so,"
May said, staring at Francis's younger face. He had the same open expression, the same prominent nose, the same full lower lip. She felt her eyes filling.
"I can't remember those frames," he said.
"I don't know where they came from. All I can think is that my regular glasses had broken, and these were hers, and she was letting me wear them."
"You look cute,"
May said. But she wanted to cry and cry. Francis was squinting at the photo, as if hoping to glean some answers from it, if he looked long enough.
"Where was this?"
May asked.
"No idea," he said.
"You don't know where you lived?"
"No clue. Even having pictures is pretty rare. Not all the Foster families would give you photos, but when they did, they made sure not to show anything that could help you find them. No exteriors of houses, no addresses or street signs or landmarks."
"You're serious?"
Francis looked at her.
"That's the foster care way."
"Why?
So you couldn't come back, or what?"
"It was just a rule."
"Yeah, so you couldn't come back. If they had you a year, that was the deal, and they didn't want you landing back on their doorstep again, especially when you got older. Some of the kids had some serious tendencies, so the families had to worry about when they got older and could track them down."
"I had no idea."
"Yeah, it's a weird system, but it makes sense." He drank the rest of his sake and got up to adjust the stereo.
"Can I look?"
May asked. Francis shrugged. May paged through it, looking for any identifying imagery, but in dozens of photos, she saw no addresses, no homes. All the photos were interiors or anonymous backyards.
"I bet some of them would want to hear from you," she said.
Francis was done with the stereo, and a new song was playing, an old soul song she couldn't name. He sat down next to her.
"Maybe, but that's not the agreement."
"So you haven't tried to contact them? I mean, with facial recognition?
I don't know. I haven't decided. I mean, that's why I brought it here. I'm scanning the pictures tomorrow just to see. Maybe we get a few matches. But I'm not planning to do much beyond that. Just fill in a few gaps."
"You have a right to know at least some basics,"
May was leafing through the pages and landed on a picture of a young Francis, no more than 5, with 2 girls, 9 or 10, flanking him. May knew these were his sisters, the 2 who had been killed, and she wanted to look at them, though she didn't know why. She didn't want to coerce Francis into talking about them, and knew she shouldn't say anything, that she should allow him to initiate any discussion of them, and if he didn't, soon, she should turn the page. He said nothing, so she turned the page, feeling a surge of feeling for him. She'd been too tough on him before. He was here, he liked her, he wanted her with him, and he was the saddest person she'd ever known. She could change that.
"Your pulse is going nuts," he said.
May looked down at her bracelet and saw that her heart rate was at 134. "Let me see yours," she said. He rolled up his sleeve. She grabbed his wrist and turned it. His was at 128.
"You're not so calm yourself," she said,
and left her hand resting across his lap.
"Leave your hand there and watch it get faster," he said,
and together they did. It was astonishing. It quickly rose to 134. She thrilled at her power, the proof of it, right before her and measurable. He was at 136.
"Want me to try something?" she said.
"I do," he whispered, his breath labored. She reached down into the folds of his pants and found his penis pressing up against his belt buckle. She rubbed its tip with her index finger, and together they watched the numbers rise to 152.
"You're so easy to excite," she said.
"Imagine if something were really happening." His eyes were closed.
"Right?"
he finally said, his breath labored.
"You're enjoying this?"
she asked.
"Mm-hmm,"
he managed. May thrilled at her power over him, watching Francis, his hands on the bed, his penis straining against his pants. She thought of something she could say. It was corny, and she would never say it if she thought anyone would ever know she'd said it, but it made her smile, and she knew it would send Francis, this shy boy, over the edge.
"What else does that measure?"
she asked, and lunged. His eyes went wild, and he struggled with his pants, trying to remove them, but just as he pulled them to his thighs, a sound came from his mouth, something like, "Oh, God," or, "I gotta," just before he doubled over, his head jerking left and right until he crumpled on the bed, his head to the wall. She backed away, looking at him, his shirt hiked up, his crotch exposed. She could think only of a campfire, one small log, all of it doused in milk.
"Sorry," he said.
"No, I liked that," she said.
"That was about as sudden as it's ever happened with me."
He was still breathing heavily, and then some rogue synapse within her connected this scene to her father, to seeing him on the couch, helpless over his body, and she wanted badly to be somewhere else.
"I should go," she said.
"Really? Why?"
he said.
"It's after 1. I should sleep."
"Okay,"
he said, in a way that she found unappealing. He seemed to want her gone as much as she wanted to be gone. He stood and retrieved his phone, which had been propped upright on the cabinet, facing them.
"What, were you filming us?"
she joked.
"Maybe,"